Today on Podcast by the Bay.
You know, there are plenty of studies. The Pew Research Center has done extensive studies on the use of social media and news. And yeah, most people say they will get their, under 30, say they get their news from TikTok, say. But when it's time to find out what really is going on, they will turn to a more credible site like the New York Times or CNN.
We speak with journalist, investigative reporter, and longtime San Mateo political insider, Mark Simon.
What that tells me is we've got American voters, the great bulk of whom are looking for someone to do something, to fix the problems they're facing. And they'll go to the left if it's Obama and Biden. They'll go to the right if it's Trump, just to solve, you know, somebody do something, somebody be definite.
All coming up on today's episode of Podcast by the Bay. Stay tuned. Podcast by the Bay is a production of Bay City Communications and is sponsored by Liberty Realty. Liberty Realty, serving the peninsula and surrounding areas since 1986 for all your real estate needs. www.liberty-realtyinvestments.com. And now, another podcast by the Bay.
Welcome to Podcast by the Bay. Today is October 7th. And I have the honor of having an opportunity to speak with Mark Simon, a well-known journalist in the peninsula. We're not going to go into complete detail on his background. I would encourage you to go on Podcast by the Bay to listen to the episode for further information about Mark Simon. Welcome, Mark Simon.
Hi, Patrick. Good to see you.
Good to see you, too. First of all, I want to start off by congratulating you. I hear you sold your house and you have a new abode. And how's that going?
It's great. It's great. You know, my late wife and I bought our house in 1980 up in the hills in Redwood City. Raised our family there. She passed away 11 years ago, and I began to think, you know, living in a two-story, four-bedroom house by myself didn't make a lot of sense, so I downsized. I'm in a two-bedroom apartment in San Carlos and very happy there.
You look very relaxed. Very, very relaxed. I know I'm living in a large house myself, so yeah. I'm probably going to think about that in the next year or two myself. So yeah. There's no reason to be in a big four-bedroom, two-bath house with a lot of stuff you're not going
to
use.
Well, it was a great chance to offload a lot of things. Went almost every day and dropped books off at the library or took stuff to Savers in Redwood City. Where else to dump? I mean, it was all over the place.
Well, first of all, I appreciate the opportunity to interview you, and we're going to just kind of have kind of questions, and not necessarily about politics, but it is about politics.
Sure.
Because life's about politics. This year coming up and next year we'll be celebrating the 250th anniversary of the United States and the Declaration of Independence. Right now we seem to be under a different kind of siege, or whatever you may want to call it with an adjective. We were a democratic republic. What's your take on what's going on in the country right now?
Well, I think it's hard to figure out if you try to be thoughtful about it. You know, everybody wants to compare this to the Civil War, and we're nowhere near that kind of a crisis. And one of the things that underlying that issue was slavery, and we don't have a crisis or even a disagreement that comes anywhere close to the kind of disagreement we had between states that enslaved people and states that did not. But that being said, you can see a lot of parallels in the rhetoric and hardened lines. I tend to think that the things aren't as divided and or as hardened as they're portrayed in the media and the social media in particular, which I think contributes to that. To me, the evidence of that is we went from George W. Bush, if you want to go back far enough, Clinton, George W. Bush, Obama, Trump, Biden, Trump. What that tells me is we've got American voters, the great bulk of whom are looking for someone to do something, to fix the problems they're facing. And they'll go to the left if it's Obama and Biden. They'll go to the right if it's Trump, just to solve, You know, somebody do something. Somebody be definite. And President Trump's, one of his great strengths is that he's definite, even if you don't agree with him or even if you think he's all over the place. He doesn't hem and haw. He doesn't quibble. So I think that was attractive to people. And then the other thing is, it's always compared to what? If you look at the campaign in 2024, it's still hard to say what the Democrats were about. Campaigns should be about four things: jobs, the economy, safety, and security. And if you're not talking about those things at any level, even the level you're at, you're not talking to what's on people's minds. Housing falls into that category. Certainly employment falls into that category. Supporting business falls into that category. Crime, but also immigration falls into the question of security and safety. So Trump was talking about those things. People think he was lying, and he may have been. But that being said, he was definite, and I think that's what attracted people to him.
Well, you know, first of all, I know we're in agreement on a lot of stuff, but we're actually, as we talk, three branches of government: executive, legislation, and judicial. There seems to be an overriding thing with the executive branch not necessarily working through the legislative and other branches of government. And the forethought, or some of the people are feeling, that the president is kind of destroying the republic, so to speak. What's your comments on that?
Well, we've had imperial presidencies before. I'm just now reading Shelby Foote's massive trilogy on the Civil War. And if you look at what Lincoln did after the war started, it's very much on a par with what Trump is trying to do. So it's not the first time we've had this. People called him a dictator then and objected that he was violating the Constitution. You know, as we speak, the Supreme Court has begun its new term. And I think a lot of us are hoping that after all the things they have done, there will be some effort by the courts to say he's gone too far. We'll see. But to think that it's a dictatorship is, to me, it's not there yet. Doesn't mean it won't be, but it's a lot has to happen still before we reach the point where we're at that kind of a crisis, it seems to me.
Well, it seems that we have a lot of changes that are going on, especially the major thing with President Trump with tariffs. And I guess when you read the Declaration of Independence, and obviously we got our freedom from England, we wanted no taxation without representation. And now we have a president that feels that we should be taxing or tariffing all these countries. What's your thoughts on that?
Well, the issue there, it's not that the part of the sentence that should be emphasized is not the taxation part, it's the representation part. If you read our history of those times, those businessmen understood that they should pay some taxes. They didn't object to it. What they objected to was taxes that were being levied without any voice expressed by them. So it's all about representation more than it is about taxation. Now, that's the issue there, is that he has implemented these tariffs without a vote by Congress, and Republican-controlled Congress has gone along with him, which is why the Democrats are clearly going to make the argument next year: if you want to take back control of our government, you need to elect the Democrats in majority, at least in one house of Congress.
Okay, so right now the representation, so he's just taking the opportunity to, since he has the House of Representatives pretty much wrapped up so far, to push his legislative agenda that's not necessarily maybe in the best interest of all kind, but in an interest of the political party in power.
Well, I mean, you know, the thing about Trump is he will keep doing what he's doing till someone stops him. And if you don't stop him and let him do it, he will keep doing it. And if you were president and you could do whatever you wanted, wouldn't you? Of course, we'd all use our powers for good and not evil. But again, he's not the first president who has tried to do this. The difference is that usually they don't have a Congress that's so willing to acquiesce to everything he wants to do.
So is this, it appears, some type of fear-based leadership, because retribution seems to come to people that don't necessarily agree with him in his own political party?
Well, it's not even retribution. It's more revenge. one of the keys to Trump is, if you want to know what he's going to do, look at what he accuses the other side of doing, because he invariably does exactly what he's accusing other people of doing. And in this case, he thinks he was misused and mistreated by the judicial system, by the FBI, by the Democrats. He's got a long list. I guess it's Trump's version of Alzheimer's. He's going to forget everything but his grudges. But so he's clearly exacting what he regards as virtuous, as righteous revenge on the people. And I'm sure if you asked him, he would say in all honesty, if that is within his capacity, he would say in all honesty, I'm merely doing to them what they tried to do to me. It doesn't excuse it, barely explains it, but that's what this is about. And if anybody thinks otherwise, you know, it's interesting. I wrote in a column a couple of weeks ago, after he had said, he had talked about hating people at a funeral, where the widow, widow had actually said she forgave the person who killed her husband. He comes on and says, I can't do that. I hate people. I hate my opponents. And I asked, how do you excuse that? Because one of the things that strikes me about Trump's supporters is how willing they are to excuse and rationalize his behavior. Well, I like him on this issue, so I'm willing to put up with these things. And the reaction I got from people writing in was, somebody said he was joking. Somebody else said, well, look what the Democrats have done. Somebody else said, well, Biden was just as bad. All of which is a rationalization to excuse his behavior. And I have continuing trouble understanding how people can be comfortable sending troops to a city where there isn't violence, where there aren't riots. The description he gave of Portland the other day made it sound like the town was burning. And it's just not. It's troublesome to sort these things out. It's troublesome to understand them. He comes at us at such a pace that it's hard just to keep up. But it's important to remember what's important to us as individuals, as people, as residents, as citizens. And that's the fundamental things. Am I able to take care of my family? Am I able to keep them safe? Am I able to live someplace decent and safe? Can I educate my children? Can I make a decent living? And that's where the stresses and strains will start to show, I suspect, within the next year.
So would it be fair to say that it's more revenge and fear-based leadership?
Sure.
Style of running the Oval Office?
Well, yeah, it is fear-based. You know, it's very much a CEO model. Over the years, I've covered a variety of CEOs who have run for senator or governor. And the big gap there is that, first of all, they don't believe being in politics requires skill and talent, when in fact it does. You have to convince people, you have to persuade people who don't have to do what you're asking them to do. There's the big difference. You can see a CEO sitting in a meeting with all of his direct reports, and he builds consensus, he takes in input, and then everybody looks at the CEO, and the CEO says, okay, here's what we're going to do. And a good CEO with good staff doesn't waste a lot of time checking to see if it gets done. It just gets done. Whereas Trump in his first term, the famous picture of Nancy Pelosi standing up and waving her finger in his face. They're not used to somebody standing up and saying, no, we're not doing that. That's the missing gap right now in our system, is that there's nobody saying to him, we're not going to do that.
Well, it appears on the surface to me that he's running it like his own TV show that he ran. So it doesn't seem to be any different than the TV show.
Well, I think he's running it more like his business, which is he liked being the center of all the decision making, and he liked being able to make them as quickly as he wanted to, as whimsically as he wanted to, and arbitrarily as he wanted to. But there's no question there's fear, and he's using that as a tool, but it's available to him. So the question isn't really whether or not he's operating as a fear-based leader. It's the question is, why are people letting him scare them? And it goes back to the Kennedy book, JFK's book, Profiles in Courage. And he liked to say, by the way, that was a small book.
Mm-hmm. Well, that sounds like it.
Yeah.
The extremes that we see on social media on both sides of the fence seem to be extreme. You know, one side said this is the far left and the other one says the far right. So why is it the strict apathy of the public, of the message of the middle of the road people, meaning Democrats and Republicans, that's not being presented? That issue does not seem to be representative. Is this just the pure apathy in this country?
I don't know if I'd use the word apathy. The greatest hazard of social media is that it makes it possible for you to have your own views reinforced over and over again. The studies show that most people are not seeking out contrary opinion on a consistent basis, and that colors what they do, what they see, what they hear, and what they choose to believe. So that's the challenge. I do think, Bob Marks and I do a podcast called The Game. We just did one when it was, and he disagrees with me vehemently. He thinks I'm way too optimistic. But I tend to think that people under 30 are probably fairly sophisticated consumers of social media. They can tell the difference. They know the difference. We'll see what happens with AI, because AI is becoming so effective at creating things that aren't real, that appear real, and are convincingly appearing to be real. But, you know, there are plenty of studies. The Pew Research Center has done extensive studies on the use of social media and news. And yeah, most people say they will get their, under 30, say they get their news from TikTok, say. But when it's time to find out what really is going on, they will turn to a more credible site, like the New York Times or CNN, some place that is theoretically devoted to providing just the information. So I think they'll grow up understanding you don't believe everything you see on the internet. I don't know how political young people are on the internet. Mostly, I think it's people like us, older people, who are used to consuming political views and are looking for reassurance and reinforcement. And I'm not sure the internet really provides that unless you really narrow your world.
Now, when President Trump got reelected this last time, there seemed to be a wave of using TikTok and social media to get the young people more engaged, and especially people of color. Do you think he did an effective job of that? I think they said that he had some 175 million viewers on TikTok.
Well, Obama is really the first one to use social media with great effectiveness, and we changed the game. Trump is a master of using those things to say things that get attention, that distract people. So he's very good at it. I mean, we saw during the shutdown debate, you know, him posting videos, social media videos. There was one I just saw this morning with the song Fear the Reaper. And it's this guy Vogt, who's the Mr. Budget Cutting on Mr. 2025, Project 2025. And he uses it. It's entertaining. It's small bites, which is what most people's attention span is nowadays. We'll see if somebody can replicate that. He has changed the game because he is such a distinctive personality. So the game has changed, but the question is, has it changed only for him? Is he still doing things that no one else could get away with? I don't know the answer. I'd like to think that some of the things he does would be troublesome, even a death knell for other people's political careers. But we'll see. I just don't think that what he does and how he does it really translates to other people and their ability to do the same thing.
Do you see any good of what's coming out of the way things are being handled through the Trump administration?
Do I see anything good? Well, you know, I guess one of the good things you could say is it's forcing the Democrats to really think about how they go about being the party of opposition. The frustration, if you're a Democrat, is that they didn't have a message. They didn't have a unifying message. And I'm waiting for someone to say what it might be and somebody to emerge. Now, that's what campaigns are for, and they often do. If you think about Harris and when she was vetting her vice presidential nominees, the Democrats have a pretty deep bench of potentially national figures who didn't have the opportunity to run in a primary. In 28, that'll be different. There'll be a dozen candidates running, and they'll be vetted by the process, and they'll learn how to develop a message. And one of Kamala Harris's great failings was that she never had a sort of coherent message that spoke to the four issues I was talking about: jobs, the economy, safety, and security. She didn't comment on immigration, which was clearly an issue that bothered people. You can argue whether or not it should have been. It was. And it still is in a lot of ways to people who are willing to let this country welcome people but are uncomfortable at the breadth with which we're doing it. It's the same thing with trans. There are a lot of people who I think believe in the idea of live and let live, but to what extent that it overlaps my life and impacts my life, I want to be reassured about that. And the reassurance you're getting from the Democrats right now is you just need to learn to accept this. And that may be the case. It sounds sort of like what people were saying 20 years ago about gay marriage and same-sex couples. But it takes a while for people to adapt to these things, and to expect them to fall in line right away is expecting something that's outside what they're worried about, which are jobs, the economy, safety, and security.
But it appears in the economy that the jobs are important in the economy, but it doesn't appear that we really have a problem. So the hard thing to grab a hold of here is that he took over when the economy was good. It still appears numbers-wise that the economy is good. We're getting more, a little bit higher unemployment. So it seems like a smokescreen. You know, he's taking credit for a good economy, which he received a good economy, and relatively low unemployment. And yet we're going after it in a process that there's high unemployment and that the country's in need of rebuilding America, so to speak. So it seems to be, the message doesn't seem to correlate with what the reality is.
Well, that's why I draw the distinction between jobs and the economy. And also, it's important to think about jobs as in what kind of jobs and how do they pay? How many people are having to work more than one job just to make ends meet? It was a really interesting story in the New York Times the other day. We're all familiar with the concern, talking again about the younger generation of 30s, 35 and under. They're growing up with social media and with screens in their face all day, every day, and we have no idea what impact that's having on this generation. We grew up, you're around the same age as me, I suspect. We grew up with air raid drills because of the Cuban Missile Crisis.
Right.
And I can still remember 7th grade, and we all had to crawl under our desks, and they drew the shades across the windows. And I remember thinking, I don't think that's going to help. And I was like 7th grade at the time. They're growing up, and there have been studies that raise interesting questions about how that affected us long-term psychologically as a generation. They're growing up with active shooter drills. Mm-hmm. And secure campus drills and those kinds of things. So they're growing up with a constant threat, or the underlying presence of a constant threat. And they're also growing up convinced that the generation of their parents has ruined the planet and may be irrevocably harmed. And then most of them are growing up thinking, I'm never going to be able to buy a house. The economy is going to be such that it doesn't work. So there are jobs, but the cost of living, that's true here in the Bay Area. We're all well aware that our children are going to struggle to buy a house. But it's happening everywhere across the country, this problem of, boy, I don't feel economically secure. So there's that part of it. The jobs may not be satisfying in terms of the needs of people as they get older and want to have families and want to raise their families and want to have a stable place to live. But on top of that, you're talking about jobs that keep changing. And that's unsettling. There was a time in Silicon Valley where if you held a job over 3 years, people thought there was something wrong with you, that that's how you got promotions. But now you're seeing some of these larger companies like Google, that were thought of as stable, Meta, and they're starting to have layoffs for the first time. And so there's a sense of insecurity, I think, that is attaching to this economy, even though right now the data looks okay. Of course, we don't know what the data will show. Because one of the things that got shut down in the government was the bureau that reports the labor statistics. The other part of it, though, is the economy, which is the cost of living. And I don't think that's nearly as rosy as the job picture. So that's why jobs is just one factor you need to look at. We will start to see the effect of tariffs. You're starting to read stories about what it's doing to certain products that people want to buy. So we'll start to see the effect of that. How long it takes before people really begin to feel it and begin objecting to it, I don't know. But I think people are aware that the cost of living is not easy.
And is that a contributing factor to the mental health issue that we have in this country? Because obviously it appears, whether it's an elderly or whether it's a young girl in school, that mental health seems to be a big priority right now. Is mental health on a verge of a big crisis in this country?
Well, I think it already is a crisis. It's at the heart of the homeless problem, which looks in many cases to be intractable. But there's an uneasiness people have that may not manifest itself as mental health issues, but it's an uncomfortable time to live.
And in your mind, if you had a magic wand, how would you approach the two issues that we just talked about, homelessness and housing?
Well, obviously the answer to housing is to build more. But the question is, can you build enough to really affect the issue? Years ago, I wrote a series of columns about El Camino. The place to build high-density, high-rise housing is El Camino. It's close to transit. It makes a whole different lifestyle. Yes, it becomes an urbanized lifestyle, which makes a lot of traditional people who've lived here traditionally uncomfortable. But it's the only way we can guarantee that this becomes something other than a wealthy enclave. It's very challenging for two reasons. One, I mentioned the apartment complex I'm living in San Carlos. It's called Trestle. It's right between El Camino and the railroad tracks. Mm-hmm. It's property that is owned by Samtrans. And when I worked at Samtrans, my job was to advocate for that project to the city council. We wanted 8 stories. We ended up with 3. Redwood City right now, and to a lesser degree, San Mateo, are the only two cities that are willing to build beyond 5 stories. And the political challenges that come with that, the angry people who show up at the city council chambers, is a challenge a lot of council members have trouble coping with. But the real answer, and the other challenge, I was just driving by a stretch of it the other day looking for there's a watch repair shop I needed in San Mateo. And each one of the shops, you could tell, was owner-occupied. So amassing a block, you may have to deal with 15 different owners over time. Then you have to get the city to approve it. One of the advantages Redwood City had is that its downtown is not immediately adjacent to residential. So they could do high-rise without a neighbor across the street throwing a fit. That's not true for other cities, including San Mateo, where you can go just one block off of El Camino, mm-hmm. and you're seeing major residential areas. So all those challenges make it hard, but that's the answer, it seems to me, is more high-density, high-rise development.
But I agree with you. As a residential real estate broker for over 40 years, it seems like the intent of building more housing, like one-bedroom and studio apartments, is what we're doing is warehousing people. If we really think about social equity is home ownership. So it appears on the surface that we're not doing anything different than what you might see in a socialist country. We're saying we need more housing, so we say to the developer, you have to build 15% to 20% affordable housing. So in reality, the affordable housing, if you're a contractor, you're only going to build one-bedroom and studio apartments. And then you're building apartments, but you're not building housing for sale because, at least in California, we have a 10-year insurance guarantee that developer could possibly be sued for malfunction. So we seem to not really think outside of the box in how we could approach the housing. Would you say that seems to make sense to you?
Yeah, you know, the question is, if you have a generation that's growing up thinking it may never own a home, then maybe they don't have to. Maybe we need, speaking of thinking outside the box, maybe we need to think the whole question of home ownership. You know, we have cities where people rent their whole lives. My parents grew up in San Francisco, met in an apartment building on Van Ness Avenue, went to Galileo High School. After they sold their house in the 1970s, I guess it was, for what they thought was an embarrassing amount of money, so funny, they rented after that because that's what they were used to. They'd grown up with that. And so I wonder if, when we talk about affordable, it may not have to be ownership. It may just be Can you make the rent? If you can make the rent and you can stay, why won't you stay? Why wouldn't you stay? Especially if it's close to a downtown or it's right on the major transit lines. You know, years, for quite some time when I was at Samtrans, we did something called the Grand Boulevard Initiative. And one of the things we learned is that on El Camino, you could turn that into a world-class Grand Boulevard. But what you needed to do was have nodes of commercial space, smaller, medium, big. So the big would be major shopping centers. The medium would be something like Sequoia Station, where there's some amenities. And then something like 25th Avenue in San Mateo, where there's some restaurants, there's a dry cleaner, there's the kind of things you could walk to. And then the rest of it is housing. And so you can get it, come out and get on a bus, and it takes you in 2 minutes to this commercial spot, get back on the bus and go home. It's almost a European model where they don't stock up on food in some countries in Europe. They go and buy their food every night and then make the dinner that night.
Do you think we're kind of going that direction with the autonomous vehicle? Because the autonomous vehicle, if we look at it from the stretcher thing, do you really need to have a 4,000 or 5,000 pound gorilla and parked in a driveway? Or will we be more adaptable to being able to have the availability of an Uber, a Lyft, or a Tesla taking you around?
Well, it's one of the things I worked on when I was at Samtrans. We actually hired a consultant out of UC Davis to look into autonomous vehicles as a part of our service. So it's coming. There's no question it's coming. I'm sure you've noticed I have, just driving on El Camino in the last month, it seems like the number of Waymo vehicles has tripled.
Absolutely.
So it's something that's coming. Again, it's all about affordability. Uber is convenient if you can afford it. And if it isn't, then you get on the bus. And the key to what I was talking about with El Camino is, right now, if you get on an El Camino bus, it stops every two blocks because somebody's getting off to go to their job at one of those stores, one of those small places that I was talking about. But if you can get on, walk out of my apartment in San Carlos and go to the bus stop at San Carlos Avenue in El Camino and take a bus to Millbrae and it gets me there in 20 minutes, well, then maybe I don't need to drive. But if I get on that bus, it's going to take me an hour because it's going to stop.
Well, you know, it seems to make sense. I heard over 50% of the people that drive 101 north and south are not going more than 20 or 30 miles.
Yeah, they're usually going one or two exits. They're not going far.
So what happened? I think Walt Disney really had it correct. I think really what we needed down at El Camino is a monorail that branched off to the different things, to the trains, to the buses.
Well, we have a transit system that serves El Camino. It just needs to be more efficient and more effective. And we need zoning and construction laws that fuel that. And the challenge is, Redwood City is doing a lot of things right. You know, the project that they're proposing at Sequoia Station is going to be fairly large. They're talking about 18 stories. You and I both know it won't end up at 18 stories. And you know the developer's trick there is see what we can get if it's not 18. But the shame of what happened in San Carlos is that they ended up at 3. They should have been 5. Should have been 8. It wasn't going to make any difference. The residents on the east side of San Carlos were saying we were going to ruin their view. I don't know of what, but they were loud enough and rambunctious enough to scare the council. And it was a brand new council. They had some new members who hadn't been there before. I think if it had been a year gone by, they would have seen this in a little different way. But that was the time and the frame in which we had to do all this.
Well, you know, I find it interesting that we do give credit for if we build near corridor transportation areas, yet we really don't know that we're going to have more people taking public transportation to make it efficient. So it sounds like we've got the right thought process, but we don't have the right transportation.
Well, we saw that with Caltrain before COVID. Mm-hmm. Caltrain was operating trains at 120% of capacity. And with electrification, it's coming back. It's even easier to use now. But that's the answer. And so that's one of the reasons why it's important for employees to tell their employees it's time to come back to the office, which you're seeing increasingly happening.
You kind of touched on it in the first question. Do you think that what we have right now is too much taxation? If you look at the housing industry, and let's just deal with San Mateo County, about 60% of your housing is owned by senior citizens, and they're not moving. And obviously, number one reason why. Either they want to give it to their kids, or but they don't want to pay the capital gains. So are we missing out on an opportunity? And some of the senior citizens say, I don't want to move out of the area. I want to stay here. So the only thing they could do is something like you did, sell your place and move into an apartment.
Yeah.
And a lot of the senior citizens aren't willing to do that. Are we missing out on an opportunity?
Absolutely.
Yeah. Okay. All right. In behalf of Podcast by the Bay, I want to thank you, Mark Simon, for giving me an opportunity to interview.
Oh, my pleasure.
Thank you.
Thanks for listening to this episode of Podcast by the Bay. You can contact us by email at podcastbythebay@gmail.com. Podcast by the Bay is a production of Bay City Communications and is sponsored by Liberty Realty. Liberty Realty, serving the peninsula and surrounding areas since 1986 for all your real estate needs. www.liberty-realtyinvestments.com. All material and content is property of Podcast by the Bay, but does not necessarily reflect the views of Podcast by the Bay. You can follow us on Twitter at Podcast by the Bay as our handle, or on Facebook, facebook.com/podcastbythebay. And remember, you can listen to any of our episodes anytime on any podcast site. Until next time, stay tuned.